This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I would start by saying that I think no public university in America has had a richer history and a more substantial legacy than the University of California. At UCSD, you proudly, and I think rightly, celebrate your many highly ranked departments, your prize-winning faculty and students, and your well-funded research projects. But it is happening excitingly in this cauldron of innovation. And you mix together the university and the companies of this region, both startups and mature companies, and a heady brew of economic activity is cooking. Moreover, the world's challenges and its opportunities are playing out profoundly in San Diego. Issues of diversity and growth, of inequality, the meaning of borders. You are, as I think the chancellor is fond of saying, a crossroad of people, commerce, and culture. For all these reasons, UCSD has the opportunity to prepare students to participate in a world where we're no longer just loosely affiliated, but we're truly interdependent. A world where we can't always just compete with one another, but we must learn how to collaborate. A world where the nature of knowledge and learning is changing rapidly due to technology. And students, therefore, must learn to think more comparatively, more holistically, and with a global mindset. I want to argue tonight that universities have an obligation to transform the landscape of their students' opportunities, to literally bring the world within their reach. Because whether that student aspires to be the next Condoleezza Rice or a biotech entrepreneur in San Diego, she will become part of a global community that profoundly influences her options and her outcomes over the coming decades. And because a university like UCSD has the power to be a very great agent of change, it must also serve as a role model of civic engagement for its students. In today's dizzyingly complex world, universities isolate them in an ivory tower at their peril. In this new globalizing world, universities must also reevaluate their local impact more compellingly. In fact, understanding the role of universities in relation to their cities is going to be increasingly important as more and more people move back to cities in the U.S. and around the world. Over the last few decades, a host of anchor institutions have breathed new life into communities, and they have forged new pathways for economic growth in their cities by engaging and investing in new kinds of partnerships. Universities and medical centers in particular have taken on this role, although so have libraries and symphonies and operas, as it will here. Viewing it, all of them, as both an obligation and an opportunity. It's an obligation for universities and medical centers because they are indeed special kinds of citizens. And good citizenship means taking responsibility, not just taking advantage of tax privileges. It's an obligation because in some cities, these same institutions often help to destroy the neighborhoods in their effort to and their drive to expand and grow. It's an opportunity for eds and meds to serve a greater social good at the same time they do well for their students, their faculty, and their mission. And it's an opportunity to be engines of economic development, because eds and meds are strategically positioned to drive how cities grow and change. In America's 20 largest cities, institutions of higher learning or academic medical centers are among the top 10 private employers. In four cities, Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and San Diego, universities of higher learning and medical facilities account for almost half the jobs. So it is clear that you can shape the direction of the local and regional economy, as well as generating enormous impact through your purchasing power, your investment strategies, your real estate holdings, your training and technical capacity, and your employment practices. It is really commendable that at this moment in its history, UCSD is systematically planning to help grow the urban core by investing in bridging its commitment to the innovation economy to downtown San Diego and developing a diverse talent pool that will benefit from and contribute to economic growth. Importantly, the plan, as you know, includes connecting in multiple ways with diverse neighborhoods surrounding the new projects, neighborhoods like the Diamond District and Golden Hill, and like Barrio Logan, where if I have time, I look forward to visiting Salud Tacos and Bordeaux Brewing. I salute Chancellor Khosla and Associate Vice Chancellor Walshock for their vision, and I welcome them to the fraternity of university leaders who have seized the opportunity and the obligation to ask themselves what they could and should do for their city. And how fortunate you are to be doing it here in this engine of economic growth and innovation called California. When I took over at Penn, our situation in Philadelphia was dramatically different. The blight of the local neighborhoods had become the plight of the university. Students felt less safe, and parents felt less comfortable sending them there. Crime had soared. 1 in 5 residents lived below the poverty level. Shops and businesses had closed. Families had abandoned houses. The streets were literally filled with trash. Pedestrian traffic vanished. Middle-class families moved out, and drug dealers moved in. And Philadelphia's municipal finances were on the ropes. We knew that we could never have a future as a truly great university in a disintegrating community and an economically weakening city, even if we were foolish enough to want such a thing. We needed to become a force for strengthening our community and building its efficacy. We needed to focus on the economic vigor of Philadelphia. We needed to be a partner, and we needed others to partner with us. Penn found that, like all anchor institutions, it had a crucial role to play, but sometimes we played the preacher, and other times we stepped back into the choir. And in the process, we demonstrated just what powerful an impact a university can have when it accepts that its destiny is intertwined with that of its neighbors. Not just an impact on the city, but also on the commitments of its students, who, because of our engagement, entered their post-Penn lives better prepared, as Gandhi said, to become the change that they wish to see in the world. To build a more vibrant urban core, we worked on safety and security, on housing and economic development, on public education and employment. We also learned that it's relatively easy to have great ideas for this work, but it's extraordinarily hard to implement them. Action, implementation, and execution, after all, are what matters. Of course, whenever I hear the word execution, I'm reminded of that famous quip by John McKay, who went from coaching national championship football teams at Southern Cal to coaching the NFL expansion Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who lost their first 26 games. During that losing streak, which stretched over 2 full seasons, a reporter once asked McKay what he thought of his team's execution. Without missing a beat, McKay replied, "I'm very much in favor of it." Now, I can tell you that when Penn first proposed devoting substantial resources towards making these kinds of investments, many members of our academic community were not much kinder. Although they didn't call for the execution of Penn's leaders, they often did wonder, sometimes aloud, what we were smoking. This is definitely not work for the faint of heart. Nonetheless, we mobilized ourselves to be an economic engine that could power renewal, and we put our own skin in the game. Specifically, we focused on 5 areas, and not piecemeal, and this is crucial, but comprehensively, simultaneously, and aggressively. We systematized and integrated all of our interventions, looking over and over again for leverage to create a dynamic multiplier effect. Let me just say a word about each of the 5. First, we would restore clean, safe, well-lit, and green streets and neighborhoods. Second, we would work to provide high-quality, diverse housing choices, both home ownership and rental, across a spectrum of options and price points. Third, we would revive commercial activity and accelerate overall economic development that would put back into the local neighborhoods the opportunity to expand and grow. Fourth, we would invest in and improve the local public schools. And fifth, we would collaborate with city, government, private sector, private developers, new startups, mature companies, everyone, to help Philadelphia realize its own economic growth aspirations. In all this work, we had to enable key faculty members to understand and support the deployment of fungible resources on non-academic expenditures. I'm not going to elaborate on each of the initiatives because several are not relevant specifically to your opportunity. But let me describe a few of the ways that I think are most relevant that we touched communities by doing that might be useful in your thinking. Penn improved more than 200 units of low-income rental housing, transforming them into attractive, well-managed, and importantly, fully occupied neighborhood assets, while at the same time we collaborated with private developers to put hundreds of units of new or renovated apartments and condominiums, often actually on university property, giving them a 40 to 90 year ground lease with reversionary clauses back to the university. We partnered with neighborhood residents, the electricians union, and the local electric company to install light fixtures that would uniformly light the sidewalks of 1,200 neighborhood properties. Not only did these efforts create brighter, cleaner, and safer sidewalks, which increase foot traffic, but by requiring whole blocks rather than just individual homes or units to commit to getting the lighting, we encouraged a revival of community block associations, block by block. And this led to many greening projects, planting 450 trees and 10,000 spring bulbs, and creating 4 public and 3 children's gardens, all the while setting the stage for a dramatic transformation of a local park where well-known drug deals went down in Philadelphia into a thriving recreational site for children and a weekly farmers market. We also worked directly with local developers to revive the retail economy and accelerate economic growth. Along one shuttered and largely dilapidated stretch of a commercial street, we built a 300,000 square foot project, including a luxury hotel, beautiful new Penn bookstore, public plazas, and a raft of stores and restaurants. And at the periphery of campus, we developed a 75,000 square foot project that would create stronger ties intentionally between town and gown, a new movie theater and a new supermarket, and scores of small neighborhood-friendly stores and restaurants, as well as artist studios and meeting places, all to reanimate a dying commercial corridor that had divided Penn, maybe intentionally, from its community. Penn had inked a deal with Robert Redford and his Sundance Cinema project to build the new movie theater. It would show independent and experimental films and feature an art gallery and a cafe, a video library, community meeting spaces, and perhaps a jazz club. Across the street would be a multi-story parking garage atop a very innovative and architecturally attractive new supermarket, Fresh Grocer, which was financed by a national developer. Construction was proceeding apace 2 years later when the parent company, General Cinema, filed for bankruptcy and pulled the plug on the Sundance Theater project. Just like that, a critical and expensive project stalled, and my lunches with Robert Redford came to an end. Predictably, some admonished Penn for biting off more than we could chew, urging us to suspend the search for another partner. True, it wasn't easy, actually, convincing our board to spend more money to seal the deal that we ultimately struck with National Amusements. But at the end of the day, and more than 2 years after the Sundance Project collapsed, the Bridge Cinema Deluxe, as it's called, which is a sensational state-of-the-art movie theater complex, open to rave reviews. The Bridge attracts over 500,000 patrons a year from all over the city. And if you would go to the supermarket, the fresh grocer, tonight at 10 p.m. or at 2 a.m., you would see throngs of students and neighborhood residents shopping and schmoozing with one another, which is very, very cool. Welcoming large crowds into the street has made the neighborhood safer and more diverse. It's been a shot in the arm for the local economy, and it's made University City more and more attractive to developers. But this wasn't just about building and attracting amenities. This was about infusing robust, sustainable economic vitality back into the surrounding neighborhoods, providing new jobs and new opportunities for local residents and businesses to thrive. We developed a detailed, inclusive approach for contracting, procurement, construction, and employment. We required that all our construction projects, both on and off campus, create substantial access for women and minorities to the trades that would do the actual building. Of the over $500 million that Penn spent on construction programs over the 7-year period from 1998 to 2004, $134 million, nearly a quarter of it, was committed to minority and women-owned businesses, mostly from the local neighborhoods. And from 2005 to 2015, that number has doubled. We also deployed our purchasing power, our own university purchasing power, more strategically, directing at least 10% of our annual university purchasing towards local vendors, which injected more than $70 million into the economy of the surrounding communities. We were going to spend the money anyway. This was a strategic spend that was focused on economic development. And we invested in small local businesses that created opportunities for workers who had been left behind by succeeding waves of economic transformations. We created many mentoring programs. Our Wharton faculty led some of those programs, one of which helped small businesses acquire e-commerce capability, enabling them to serve not just us more effectively, but making them more viable and more competitive in the open market. And today, Penn employs more than 6,000 local residents in the universities and its hospitals. This was a strategic decision, which we have then implemented. I am the first to admit that this was really challenging work, but by reorienting the way we worked as an institution, with whom we worked, and what we were willing to commit to doing, we found a way to help make the city and the university prosper together. And over time, skeptical bystanders became engaged stakeholders. And there is no doubt that Penn 2 was transformed by this effort. We overcame decades of hostile and dysfunctional relationships with our neighbors. And while not predictable at the outset, this deep civic engagement improved our rankings, our faculty awards, our student applications, and our selectivity. What have we and other engaged anchor institutions learned? I would say each of us has had somewhat different initiatives, but the common core in all of them has been seeing the value of replacing inaction with action and isolation with partnership. From Penn's experience, I'd like to offer 8 lessons that I hope can help your thinking as your downtown work unfolds. First, any successful urban strategy must be just that, strategic. It must be bold, yet based on realistic and full assessment of the social, economic, and political forces at work, and it must have a clear roadmap towards implementation. Second, it must be holistic. It is the only way to capitalize on resources effectively, to leverage the impact of individual interventions, and to promote greater sustainability. Third, collaboration and transparency are both critical. You cannot do this work in secret, and you need to partner like crazy. You cannot and should not do it alone. Fourth, we learned that there is never a universally shared perspective and only rarely a clear definition of community. Individual, family, and institutional needs can vary widely from one street to another. Effective community development, then, requires engagement with many different groups and many different interests, with many different citizens and neighborhoods, schools and churches, sometimes block by block and group by group. My husband used to tease me that when I came home, I had the most kissed cheek in Philadelphia. And it was true. I was out there all the time. Since each city block has its own perspective, each block ought to also have a voice in the needs assessment. You cannot do this to them. You can't even do this for them. You must do this with them. But not everyone has an equal say in making the decisions, so leadership at the top really, really matters. Fifth, be really careful about raising expectations. You must be willing to say what you can and cannot do, what you will and will not do. Identify and act on a few highly visible targeted initiatives. Define measurable goals and make mid-course corrections when necessary. Sixth, and I emphasize this here, your on-campus planning and your downtown program need to be integrated with your community development goals, even if they are geographically separate. You cannot plan your campus over here and plan your community development over there and hope you can have as much impact if you do not link the two in your thinking. That allowed Penn, for example, to leverage all our construction activities at many different sites as training and employment for our targeted communities. Seventh, while time is of the essence, patience is essential. Economic development and civic leadership is a journey, not a destination. We all want it to happen in an instant to show the Polaroids of the before and after. But the truth is that change will come in fits and starts. And the first step is just making sure that you're headed in the right direction. Things don't and won't always work out as planned. Eighth, happily over time. These efforts will not just transform your city. They will challenge and capture the scholarly imagination of your faculty, and they will become magnets for students who are excited by the ideas and the passion that this commitment represents. At Penn, we educated through action, building on the powerful notion that talented students would contribute more to society when they left Penn if we offered them an institutional example of active engagement while they were there. Because we, as an institution, participated in the choreography of democracy, our students learned firsthand, along with us, the challenges and the abiding value of partnership and of the participatory process. I urge you to push yourselves further than you might first have imagined, because I have seen firsthand the opportunity for universities to do well for themselves by doing good for their urban core and their local communities. Think about UCSD's enduring mission as part of America's foremost public university. You were founded to serve a vital public function. You should be emboldened to lead. Thank you.
Thank you, Judith. Right here. I'm going to give you another kiss on the cheek.
Thank you.
You know, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Judith Rodin a number of times. One of them was for a Delta Airlines leadership series. Now, I know there's a reason I'm telling you this. I don't often fly Delta. I fly United generally. I'm stuck in their mileage program. But I was walking by a Delta counter. People were getting off the plane, and they didn't know my name. They just said, ooh. Judith Rodin, oh my God, you were just interviewing her on our TV screen in Delta. She's a superwoman. So it's a little intimidating, and I do want to get a little bit of time. We're going to do a lightning round of questions and discussion between ourselves, but want to make sure you have an opportunity to interact with this extraordinary national leader. Judith, you have, I know more about you than the audience does, but let's just suffice it to say that blight, underdevelopment, trauma, dysfunction in communities, you've been trying to figure out the playbook for a long time, not only in Philadelphia, but around the world. You have taken resilience. I have to say that 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, I bet resilience would have seemed like a very exotic word. But Judith Rodin has made this part of our vocabulary. We think about it. We see storms. And I would be remiss, and I feel very awkward raising this, but today is going to be one of the darkest days in American history. October 2nd, Las Vegas, awful things. And you are very much about trying to get communities to think about resilience in health, education, their community, their physical structures. But sometimes bad things happen. And so there's the playbook after the fact. And I just want to get your thoughts on Las Vegas today.
The idea of resilience is really that you can't predict every bad thing that's going to happen or where it's going to happen. And today is a prime example, an unimaginable example. And so the institutions, the cities, the individuals who really are able to develop the adaptive capacity to rebound more quickly and effectively after something terrible happens, and to use it as an opportunity to grow and change, not merely to put things back only the way they were. And often after crisis and catastrophe, we want everything to get back to normal as quickly as possible. But normal may have created some of the underlying vulnerabilities that led to some of the difficulties in rebounding. So resilience is about planning where and what you can, but not looking in the rearview mirror, always doing it in reference to the last crisis. I saw that firsthand in New York. I chaired for Governor Cuomo New York's recovery from Sandy. And many of the large New York buildings had put the generators in their basements because, after all, 9/11, all the generators that were in the air got attacked.
Right.
And so the basements all flooded and New York went down for 2 days. And we know that story. So this is about developing that kind of adaptive capacity. It will be critical in Las Vegas how we recover. And what the local officials, what the local community, what people, I won't give a scree on gun control, but we need to learn something from these disasters. But think about it this way. In the 21st century, it may be that crisis is the new normal.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a week that goes by that we don't have a violent storm or a terrorist attack or a
cyber hack,
you know, or an earthquake or a, and so resilience is about the capacity not to withstand everything, but to be able to recover more effectively.
You tell the story of Penn and your leadership there a little bit neatly, and you said there were some rough tots here, and everybody. But it is kind of a warm and fuzzy story in a way that you, the way you tell it. I'm interested in, you know. But I know the truth is, you were the first woman head of an Ivy League university. You came into a monstrous set of problems. Not everyone liked you or trusted you. A lot of challenges. And I'm just interested because we have a lot of city stakeholders here, and they're trying to sort of wrestle with challenges from the university and others. What was your North Star in getting to a place where everyone loved you, trusted you, had confidence in you?
It wasn't that.
Yeah.
that wasn't what I was aspiring to. So the North Star really was, and this is more than the warm and fuzzy part only, honestly, it really began to be clearer and clearer to me that we couldn't separate the university. We are really cheek by jowl in the city.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that. It really was that our students were being trained to live in a world that was becoming so fundamentally different. And part of what was different was both global, but it was also increasingly local. And so How could we exhort our students to become civically engaged if we didn't role model what a civically engaged institution
looked
like?
But Judith, you had to come packaged with some of this, because the notion that you were setting up economies that worked for the local community, I knew about the dry cleaning and other things. You know, universities are not exactly bastions of fine capitalism,
That's
right?
True.
They're sort of Brezhnevian, you know, in many cases. So it is interesting that you had the confidence to think that the market power, the dynamics of the university could be used not to recreate university forces, which aren't driven really by market. They're driven by other gravitational
exactly.
forces. So how did you get that right?
We had a wonderful board, and one of the things the board did early in this process was create a neighborhood initiatives board committee and gave it statutory authority. So it sat right next to the audit committee or the finance committee, and it was something really important for the trustees to commit themselves to. We actually encouraged and then truly incented our various deans to play a part in this. So the deans of nursing and medicine and dental were setting up community clinics together in schools that weren't being used after 3 o'clock, so to try to leverage resources that way. Wharton ran all the entrepreneurship programs, and the students fought to be mentors to some of these businesses. And they gave us great ideas. For example, you mentioned the laundry. So Penn is the largest private employer in Philadelphia, and we own 5 hospitals and 3, at the time, 300 physician practices and nursing homes and whatever. And everybody was sending out their laundry to different places. And so all we did was help create a neighborhood-centered and staffed laundry. It's now the largest laundry in the tri-state area, by just telling everybody, let's give our laundry to one place. So we didn't spend any more money. We didn't do it. That's what I mean by really looking for leverage. And it just started to take hold. But you're right. It's warm and fuzzy now. It's great writing these speeches, you know, with the benefit of hindsight. It was really, really tough. And there were times when I would ask myself, do I have the right to do this?
I think that tough story is useful for people to hear, so they're not discouraged.
Right.
Because it's clear to see what you've built there, what you've done. Now, the other part of the, I know you're here for a couple of days and you're going to be going to the border, you're going to be talking about building institutions. You have, you know, they ought to be called, you know, rodent fellows, I guess, but there are resilience officers in cities all over the world. The Rockefeller Foundation had a contest for cities to compete to kind of look at what they could do and as you said, systematize and bring in resilience thinking inside their cities. How does San Diego stack up to some of the cities that you've invested in?
Oh, that's a very tough question. So the competition didn't pick the best. It picked those that were clearest mm-hmm. about what their stresses, both chronic and acute, were, who were able to demonstrate a lot of cross-sectoral collaboration already, because this is what it would take, and who understood the importance of integrating resilience across social and economic factors, as well as natural and built infrastructure. So many of the cities who were chosen were just at the beginning of that journey, and many, like Rotterdam, mm-hmm. which surprised us that they even applied, we're obviously very far along, at least in part of it. So I'm not a judge of San Diego. I can't say where it would stack up. But I do think that cities that don't think this way will increasingly both get left further behind, and they will become less resilient, and therefore they won't be able to withstand some of these challenges when they come, whether they're environmental or social.
I don't know if this is a fair question or not, because I'm not advocating for San Diego in this case, but I am interested because your contest had international cities and American cities. And I'm interested in whether, as you looked at American cities, there was a kind of regular blind spot where they weren't thinking in ways that international cities were. Is there a gap between the way we're seeing the world and organizing ourselves versus the way, say, São Paulo is organizing itself?
just to put a context on this, because it is really exciting, we did this on our centennial, and we therefore we chose 100 cities. So that was the kind of rate-limiting factor from a branding thing.
100 years of Rockefeller,
right.
100
but
resilience
we had
officers.
1,100 cities from 47 countries apply. So it's very clear that around the world there is a felt need for this kind of thinking. I would say that American cities are largely further ahead. Rotterdam is an obvious exception, and some of the others as well. And it was harder to get some of the other cities, particularly European cities, to focus until recently on the social and economic development part of it. For example, Paris focused only on flooding of the Seine until they had their terrorist attacks. And now they have switched, really focusing their resilience building on the issues that are quite central. Rotterdam, in its application, talked about its immigrant population and the need, no matter how safe they were from a physical infrastructure, to really be better in terms of social economic. The one thing that most cities around the world in all of these applications have in common, 80% of the cities, and I think you know this from the World Economic Forum data, is issues around water.
Right.
So too much, too little, flooding, not enough water, and the like. And that sort of links all cities, because so much of the urban core has been built on coastlines or on river and river deltas. And so there's a tremendous reservoir now of new knowledge that's developing. And one of our goals was really that cities would be able to share this, that they didn't any longer need to learn alone and spend money and make mistakes if they could unify. And one of the things we'll do once we get the third cohort of cities up and running, because they get a chief resilience officer and a very sophisticated strategy and then very innovative finance around how to pay for new projects, is we're going to open the information part of the network to any city that wants to participate.
Let me ask you a question about philanthropy and how you see it. And just to give the audience a snapshot, you've been on both sides of the philanthropy game, both raising money and also part. I liked in your comments how you said partnering with everyone, but philanthropists are a key part of that. If any of you really want to be moved enormously, go and read about the Rockefeller Foundation in the 1930s. The Rockefeller Foundation saved refugees in Europe, primarily Jewish refugees who were being harassed, lost their jobs, and being killed. And what I found interesting is I went into the archives, thanks to Judith, to really read the letters that were involved with program officers who said, we're a public health organization, but this isn't what we do. And there were fights within the institution about who to save, who not to save, how to change the institutional course and direction and vector. I think it was one of the most interesting things I've ever read, because you had this huge global foundation of global impact that created public health awareness around the world and in the United States. And yet it had to sort of change its rules. You change the rules wherever you go. You created social impact investing. You've raised that resilience at the foundation. What are your thoughts? There are a lot of philanthropists in the room, to philanthropists and how they can do better than they're doing.
I think the critical thing, and this comes really from my training as a psychologist, I think you need to look at action as it fits within that the context of that moment. So you can have a great idea for action, but if it bumps up against the situational factors, it's less impactful. So we were very lucky at Rockefeller because John D. had the wisdom to say, you know, I'm not going to set a particular course or a set of particular areas. I fervently believe that each new generation should pick the most significant challenges of its generation, and I hope my successors at the Rockefeller Foundation will have the wisdom and be able to consult broadly enough to pick and choose and pick the right one. So I think the best philanthropy is really very, very mindful of context and both trying to fix it. It was John Dee in those mm-hmm. in those right. Archive letters that you saw. He's it's so interesting. It's 1910, and he and Andrew Carnegie are starting their foundations, the first two in America, and they're writing each other letters about what the it's going to be. They're not trying to convince one another what to do because they had very different views of what they were going to invest in. But what is philanthropy and how is it different from charity? And Rockefeller writes in one of his letters to Carnegie, I think that philanthropy should be different. I see charity as putting bandages on weeping wounds. Mm. Now, Rockefeller tithed all his life. He was enormously charitable. But he wanted philanthropy to be solving problems at their root cause. And so he's pushing Carnegie to try to differentiate that. That has been a North Star for us at the foundation for 105 years.
And it's well worth looking at because it's also about how institutions struggle with what their purpose is.
Exactly.
And change course sometimes is what I'm saying. Let me just wrap this part of it up, Judith. I mean, it would be remiss of me not to ask you about how you see women in the world. And you are a global figure, and we have Angela Merkel, who just basically was in place. There are 22,000 women running now for political office in the United States. It was about 900 a few years ago. There is a new feature in both the political world and the business world, more attentiveness. There's a Billie Jean King movie out called Battle of the Sexes. So when do you think that you, as a leader in this, and other women, will eventually have achieved what needs to be achieved?
I accept all of the groups that you lumped together except business. Mm. I think business is woefully behind. In my last 2 years at Rockefeller, we looked at the Fortune 500. And only 5% of the companies in the Fortune 500 are led by women. And that number has women have come and women have gone, but it's sort of 23-ish to 25-ish at any particular time. We decided, again, I'm a research psychologist, so I decided to look at the data. We decided only to look at media, both print and other media sources, not social media, in a variety of ways, comparing women and men. So we found some extraordinarily interesting things. Mm. When women CEOs were appointed, in 78% of the articles, they talked about their family, a variety of personal, often their appearance. Never is that in an article about a male CEO. In 40% of the cases in which women were appointed, they were appointed when the company was in crisis. I think it was 20%.
I wondered if you were on the Uber CEO list.
God no. I wouldn't touch that one. And then, really interestingly, when a woman failed, she was personally blamed in the media. It wasn't her company. It wasn't whatever the issues, you know, bad economic market, bad products, whatever. Far more significantly than men, and most significantly, there's never been a male CEO, a female CEO in corporate America, who's been fired, who's been hired as a CEO again. Mm. And that number is significantly higher for men. So, well, has to be higher than zero. So there are a variety of ways in which these issues are still and need to be still front and center. So I end this by just how I felt as the first woman Ivy president. I was almost the first everything at Yale that I did, and certainly.
Were you ever nervous?
I was always nervous.
Okay.
The goal is the goal that Ruth Bader Ginsburg articulated, which is that it will no longer be notable. And then you will know that it's real. And I think we're not there yet.
Right. That's a great answer. Let me invite folks that come in the audience. Hello, sir.
Phil Blair with Manpower. Some great ideas, Mr. Rudd. Thanks for being here. We always learn from failure. Can you share with us something that didn't go right at Rockefeller Foundation or at Penn and what you learned from it? Wish you had done differently?
Great question.
Penn, as I articulated all of the ways we had leverage through our health system, had built this hugely integrated, vertically integrated health system from really soup to nuts. And our CEO of the health system at the time was admired nationwide for having done that. When the 96 Balanced Budget Act was passed, it took the graduate medical education out of the Medicare payments. And we lost $90 million the first year because we had such a vertically integrated system. And we were on a path to lose $150 million the next year. And so that was the most horrific experience of my career. I fired him. I had my resignation letter in the top drawer because, after all, I was his boss. And there were a lot of members of the board who really felt that he was a significant figure and unfireable. It was often characterized as a male-female thing. It was Judy and Bill, you know, fighting a powerful woman and a powerful man. And I learned through that really near-death experience that getting it right after failure is critical. And maybe that's the resilience lesson, that I learned that it wasn't about how you failed, it was about how you recovered and who you recovered with and who you partnered with and how you consulted. By the end of that process, we had all of the medical faculty on board. You know, we divested some of the hospitals, but our board was ready to sell. It was the time when there were a lot of acquisitions by private healthcare companies of university hospitals. And Penn has owned the first hospital in America, Pennsylvania Hospital, the first teaching hospital in America, the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. I just didn't think we could sell, but I learned how hard it is to get it right after you have failed so badly.
Well said. And I've seen Judith very personally and actively in the whole institution take that notion of recovery to places like Katrina, you know, to sort of in New Orleans, and look at recovery as the model. I think it's well done. Yes. Hi. How are you?
Hi. Lori Smith, commercial banker on Julian Parra's team at Bank of America. In San Diego.
Thank you for all of this.
Yes. Yeah.
In San Diego, downtown specifically, we have a tremendous homeless population. Mm. And now, in addition, a little bit of a hepatitis outbreak. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, if you faced any challenges of the homeless, and how did you work through that?
Well, we didn't... In the Rockefeller initiatives, we didn't solve it, but we worked with the cities to come up with their own solutions. This is really work that enables the cities to learn together about how to confront these kinds of problems. And I really do think, and I'll reemphasize again what I just said, that every city is different. So what you need to learn is not necessarily how to do it, with some prescriptive playbook, you need to know and learn how to go about doing it, which is different. We are seeing some colossal failures on this coast of a city where the mayor can't go out of City Hall without being shouted down by the homeless population. Clearly, that's not the right strategy that other cities want to get towards in terms of a situation. So I do think that consulting. This sounds so trite, but it is really profound. You can't do things to these people. You shouldn't try to do things for these people. It only works when you try to do it with them.
This may not be the right metaphor. Anybody here from Oklahoma City? Been through Oklahoma City? Nobody willing to admit it? Yeah, you are. Okay, good. Judith, the Rockefeller Foundation in the Atlantic did a series of forums on public health and public health resilience. And the mayor of Oklahoma City is this really interesting, kind of conservative, but crazy, wacky, creative guy. And they were very happy. They were listed as one of the fastest growing cities in the country and got all the magazine covers. But they were also one of the most obese cities in the country. And the obesity was a huge issue. And his own obesity, as he was talking about it, was an issue. And so he convinced 40,000 people to go online, to basically, the city lost $1 million.
And together.
I'm not joking. The city lost $1 million. What it led to was a complete change in orientation about public works investment, making a walkable city, beginning to try to find ways in which, you know, taking a different frame. I just want to throw that out there because I don't know the solution to the homeless problem, but I do know that sometimes bank shots are the way to go. And the idea for some of this came out of the Rockefeller Foundation roundtables. Do we have one more comment question? Yes, hi.
I'm Cindy Olmsted, and I am the chair of the San Diego Public Library Foundation. And I've just been very intrigued by your conversation, how much you referred to the boards and how much support you had from your board. Could you give all of us in the room, because we are all sit on boards, what you did or how you were able to get a board that was embracing the directions that you wanted to go in?
Great question.
A really important question. And thank you for noticing how many times I talked about the board, because in not-for-profit institutions, sometimes board members leave their critical thinking at the door. And they don't treat the philanthropic boards or the civic boards with the same rigor that they treat other boards on which they sit in the for-profit sector. And so the critical thing is for board members to understand that all of these institutions serve an enormous mission. I used to say at the Penn Hospitals, just because we're not for profit doesn't mean we're for loss. You know, let's figure this out, guys. So you need the same rigorous mindset, and you need board members to embrace that and to use all of the strategic skills and all of the creative skills that made them the kind of people that you wanted to put on your board for these kinds of thinking and ideas as well. And as I said, at Penn, we institutionalized some board committees around these issues because we wanted to emphasize the importance of it.
Well, Judith, I just want to say thank you for your expansive thinking, your bold thinking, your leadership at a national level. I have become an honorary wannabe San Diegan thanks to UC San Diego, and I hope you will join me in that status and come back often. Ladies and gentlemen, Judith Rodin.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.